43 in Racine, 41 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Many of you recognize that music, I'm sure, as from Rodgers and Hammerstein's great musical Oklahoma, their first collaboration for the Broadway stage. What you may not know is that there is a third name that is indelibly linked to this and to many other scores from the golden age of the Broadway musical. That name, Robert Russell Bennett, the man responsible for orchestrating Oklahoma and any number of other major shows. And we're going to be spending for the next few minutes, we're going to be talking about the legacy of Robert Russell Bennett, which actually even extends well beyond this accomplishment. But even this alone makes him an immortal name in American music history. I'm so pleased to be able to spend the next few minutes talking on the morning show with George Ferenz, a retired member of the music faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, who has just written a brand new book about Robert Russell Bennett's award-winning work for the series Victory at Sea. But today, as kind of a preliminary conversation, we're going to be focusing instead on a fascinating book that Professor Ferenz edited called The Broadway Sound, the Autobiography and Selected Essays of Robert Russell Bennett, in which Mr. Bennett, in his inimitable style, talks not only about his own life, the important events in it and what shaped him as a musician, but also talks about all kinds of incredible collaborations in which he engaged, playing such an important role in so many facets of American life through the 20th century. It's a great, great book. It was lent to me by a colleague of mine at Carthage College, Dr. James Ripley, who is a good friend of Professor Ferenz. And so I'm so happy to be able to have this conversation now about the great Robert Russell Bennett. George Ferenz, we welcome you to the morning show.
I'm very happy to be invited. Thank you much.
Glad we can have this conversation. I want to give credit where credit is due. It's my best friend, Marshall Anderson, a retired member of the theater faculty at Whitewater, who knows you well, who alerted me to the recent publication of your book about the Victory at Sea. And so I am grateful to my friend for helping make this connection possible. So tell us, first of all, something about your own initial encounter with the name Robert Russell Bennett. When did you first sort of see the name or hear this man's music and begin to come to an understanding of just how important he was?
That's a great question. Glad to talk to it. I'm not from a musical family per se. but my parents had some Broadway original cast albums in the house, like a million middle-class homes did. I grew up in suburban Cleveland, by the way. And I started to notice Mr. Bennett's name on these Broadway albums, and I had no idea exactly what orchestrators do. That came later. But then at the same time, I was playing in my junior high and high school band and orchestra, and we were playing both some of Bennett's original pieces, his compositions, and then those Broadway medleys, you know, Oklahoma, The Sound of Music, and so on. Then a million school and community and professional band and orchestras still play today. And I, so then I came to realize, oh, this guy's pretty cool. He does this classical composing thing. He does this commercial arranging thing. And then all the way through college as a music major and in my 20s, I just learned more about what he was doing. I always found him interesting, but it was then my first college teaching job in the 1980s was in the state of Idaho. And that's, I think, when I really got interested in learning more about this guy and got a contract to write a short reference book about his life. This is a pre-internet day, and if you went to the music library looking for information about him, you found a little bit here, a little bit there, not much. So I got a contract to do a bio-bibliography, where it was my job to track down every composition he wrote, every Broadway show he did arrangements for, every LP record he contributed to. And that got me going. That's the late 1980s. That led me to finally meet his family, his survivors, and the book you mentioned called The Broadway Sound. That's the autobiography that Russell Bennett left behind when he died in 1981. And the family thought I was doing good work on his behalf. They invited me to be its editor, and then that got published in 1999. It's hard to believe that's more than 20 years ago, but time does fly, and I'm happy to be with you. But that's a good summary of how this all got started, I think.
Great. I'm curious to know about this autobiography. Again, Mr. Bennett died in 1981 at the age of 87, and it was really some years later that this autobiography finally saw print. Do you understand what was behind that delay?
Well, I don't think this is telling tales out of school, but I'm told that the family shopped it around to the New York publishers, and that they really wished he told more catty stories about the personalities he worked with. You know, they just wanted him to dish more, to have done more. And even in the preface of the book, you read it, and he says, I'm not here to embarrass people living or dead. And so he tells a few sweet stories, but he definitely, it isn't, for all that he surely saw and heard, it wasn't going to be one of those kinds of things. And actually, in his draft of it, he drafted it all in longhand and then gave it to a typist to type up. There's some things he writes out and then crosses out, and it's just, you know, I don't need to leave this for posterity. So when you read his memoir, you get to know his general personality and good humor. A bunch of people called him the nicest guy in the music business, but that's kind of why the book sat for a while. And so the family said, you're on the academic side of things. Maybe some academic press would want to publish the whole story. And as editor, some people leave behind manuscripts that need a lot of editing, but this one didn't really at all. I reshuffled a little bit of the chronology and things. But I would say I ghost wrote only two sentences in the whole thing just to tie one thing to another. And it was my job to footnote and explain a personality or a little background that maybe the reader wouldn't know. So to get that into print at last was a great thing. That's the University of Rochester Press, where the Eastman School of Music is. And though Russell Bennett didn't go to school there, he had many ties to it. And I think it was a very fitting place to get that.
Fantastic.
Story in print at last, yes.
Right. And of course, I suppose another reason why a publisher might be reluctant to publish a book like this is because, frankly, for every person like you or me who noticed the name Robert Russell Bennett, probably most of the time in small print on the back of a given recording, I mean, the typical person would not know the name at all, or if they know the name, would not understand the significance of the man behind that name or the scope of his activities.
It's fair to say that, you know, his fame attaches to names better known than his in the theater, in Hollywood, in radio and television, and he knew that, but I realize not everyone does.
We're speaking with George Ferenz about the book The Broadway Sound, the autobiography and selected essays of Robert Russell Bennett. George Ferenz served as editor for this book, which spells out the amazing life and career of Robert Russell Bennett, a career which encompassed so many facets of American music. And it's truly staggering, his legacy. Let's talk a little bit about just the basic outline of his personal life. And let's begin with the fact that he is born in the Midwest in Kansas City, Missouri. How much do you think the fact that he was a product of the Midwest had to do with the kind of man he grew to be and the way in which he lived his life and carried out his career?
That's a great question. I suppose I can never answer, but he first of all, was never ashamed to have Midwestern roots, although he realized at some point, if you want to get into the business, you go to New York City, and that's what he did before he had even turned 20. But he certainly, if he's a Midwesterner, if he kind of knows the middle part of the country, whatever middle America is, and it was his job to compose or arrange music for the average person, not the Manhattanite, he certainly knew how to do that. Again, and he finished high school at 16, and he got to work with Nadi Boulanger on music, but he didn't have the benefit of graduate degrees in music or that sort of thing. Nonetheless, a tidbit for you, Jonathan Tunick, the arranger, the orchestrator for all the Sondheim shows, I've gotten to know him because of our mutual interest in all this, and he knew Mr. Bennett. He called Russell Bennett the most educated man I ever knew. So he made it his job to become well-educated in a million ways, not just through schooling, but through his own initiative.
I wish I could find the line. I'm looking for it right now. It's at some point in the book, he kind of talks about how he essentially waited for opportunities to come to him. That is, he did not apparently set out with some grand design in mind about what he would accomplish or what he would be able to do, but just sort of trusted that various opportunities. Here we go. I found it. I'm so glad. He writes at one point, his highest aspiration was to be, of all things, an opera conductor, preferably a Wagnerian opera conductor. But ultimately, he said he kind of gave up that dream. He writes, "Instead, I waited for music to come to me, doing each task as I was expected to do it, never at all sure of making good, but trusting fate to steer for me. Fate chose to guide me to many beginnings." I think that's such an interesting philosophy of life, and I don't know how common it is for someone who to achieve the success that he did to go about it in exactly that way. But do those words make sense to you in terms of what you know about Robert Russell Bennett and how his career ultimately unfolded?
Well, that really does sound like him, and that sounds like the kind of thing a person would write. Fatalist or not, the thing one would write late in life when you've had a pretty good life and it all seems to have unfolded, yet when we're young people, it's all a bunch of question marks out front. What's going to happen? And it can all look pretty much as though it was meant to be, I suppose, at age 75 or 80. But that does indeed sound like him. I've only heard a very few recorded interviews of his voice. There aren't many out there. But the man you meet in his memoir, it really is him. It's not a ghost-written thing. It's not compiled from interviews or something. It really is like getting to know the man. And I think he really just, he had his own ambitions, and they changed a little bit in his early years, as a lot of us do. But he clearly trusted that doors would open and that he would earn his way and that... Some students ask me, how do I get a job doing X? And there's not always a degree path or a certain way that will get you there, but you just have to trust that if you do good work, it will get noticed. And I think that certainly was part of his rise to the top in many, many good ways.
ahead of us talking about what he is now most famous for, the orchestrations he did for the great Broadway musicals of the Golden Age, give our listeners some sense of the wide array of musical pursuits in which he engaged before his name was made as a Broadway arranger. As we read through this biography, we kind of lose count of all of the different musical things that he did and did so very well.
Yeah. Well, certainly there are plenty of people who work as arrangers, and that's a big broad field with a lot of styles of music, who might have a lot of what I'll call classical training and that whole sort of thing, whatever degrees they might have. But it's very easy to get into commercial work and then sort of stop or put your concert hall aspirations on a sort of a back burner. Okay. Most of the other orchestrators for Broadway shows don't have this big resume of concert works they kept writing their whole life long, but that's really what distinguished Russell from his colleagues, I would say. But it's really quite something. And it's, of course, part of it is the technologies as they came along. Commercial radio starts up in the 1920s, and he's landed in New York by then and eventually gets to be doing radio shows where he's hosting and dealing with that thing where you never see your audience at all and they're connected with you only through a little speaker. And then, of course, his Broadway career orchestrating shows goes from the early 20s into the mid-1970s. That's a huge 50-year swath of things, and topics and technologies changed a little bit in there, too, but he was around for that. Television, of course, got its start before World War II, and then the brakes went and got put on. But when commercial TV exploded in the post-war 40s and 50s, that was another door open to him as well, because he could deliver a musical product. And I think it's very important, I'm still not in the concert hall for a second, so much about commercial music making is about delivering something that someone wants, that someone's paying you to do, and then the deadline, whether it's orchestrating a new Broadway number overnight or getting something on the radio or arrangements you need for a record album session tomorrow. He was ultra-dependable about getting his deadlines met. Now, all that said, all those wonderful things he did to earn his living, he kept at the composing always, and it's a really noble thing. There are more than 200 concert works of his. I don't pretend that they're all great masterworks or that sort of thing. A few of them get played all the time, especially his concert band pieces. But I really admire him for doing that. It would be like a TV sitcom writer who was also writing straight stage plays and doing his best to get those performed. So I love the double-sided aspect of his career. I hope that fills it in for you a little bit.
That's great. I especially enjoyed reading about the work he did playing, I think, organ in a theater. And he also mentions very offhandedly something that where my eyes just lit up, that when the great Italian tenor Beniamino Gigli came to town and apparently his accompanist was suddenly ill or unavailable, and it was, if I read this correctly, it's Robert Russell Bennett who steps in and accompanies this great tenor in this recital. I mean, once you're done reading this biography, you're just left staggered, wondering if there was anything that Robert Russell Bennett couldn't do. But on top of it, the fact that he tells us about this in such a fresh and often kind of self-deprecating, charming fashion. I mean, we end up not resenting him for being such a wide-ranging genius. We just find ourselves kind of falling in love with the guy the more we read about him and the more we read about the life he lived.
There's wonderful modesty through everything he tells us about what he's done and why he's done it. He was a good pianist. He wasn't a concert pianist, but he was a good pianist. A couple of his classical violin pieces for just violin and piano, pieces of the 1940s, he's actually on a recording of one of those if you ever want to hear his playing. This was a good friend, let me mention a name, Louis Kaufman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N. Louis Kaufman, another one of these wonderful dual career things. As a violinist, he was a Hollywood concertmaster for decades, most prominently in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. and you can hear his, he's the guy that plays with the violin section and then all the violin solos on films like Casablanca and a zillion others. He's got his own memoir out there. And then Louis Coffin also kept up his concert hall thing, playing engagements across the country, recitals, orchestra concertos and things. One of the pieces Russell Bennett wrote for him in 1940 when they're both working in Hollywood, that pair recorded for Victor Records. And then Yasha Heifetz heard it and said he wanted to play it. So those two got to go to Heifetz's apartment and play it for him, and then Heifetz took it up. And for my friends that say Russell Bennett never amounted to much as a composer, I say, hey, you would kill to have Heifetz record some of your stuff. So, and Russell can tell you that same story and sound very modest doing it. He indeed has a great capacity for doing exactly that.
Hmm. So let's get into the business of his orchestration of these great shows. And you can help us, I think, understand just what the significance of this legacy really, really is. One thing that Robert Russell Bennett says in his autobiography is the vast majority of Broadway's tune writers didn't know their ankles from their uncles when it came to the orchestrations, and that's how we all got to assume a certain importance. And he goes on to say there was probably never a tune writer in the world so simple-minded that he didn't have many ideas as to how the orchestra should sound playing his music. But the craft of putting the sounds on a piece of paper and having a bunch of musicians sound that way is something else. It seems like in those few words, Robert Russell Bennett is nicely summarizing kind of the challenge that is involved with this. First of all, maybe you could clarify this matter of Broadway composers, that some were perhaps equal to the task of orchestrating, but many were not or could not or chose not to engage in that part of creating a score.
And this is a big, big, big topic, which is as applicable today as it was then. First of all, something people should understand about when a new Broadway show goes into rehearsal, and of course time is money, and Actors' Equity limits the amount of rehearsal period, and there's all kinds of music arranging work that can't begin until a show goes into rehearsal, and we've decided exactly what the routine will be for this number, exactly what key the singer will sing it in, and so on and so on. So in that, I'll call that roughly 5-week rehearsal period for a new show, there's not much the orchestrator could have done ahead of time. And the orchestrator is a very busy person. So even if the composer could have done the orchestra arranging, Leonard Bernstein could have done that, I think, darn well for West Side Story. He just doesn't have the time while the show is in rehearsal period. And so if only for the time squeeze, you need an orchestrator. As far as the great songwriting talents of Broadway, and I'm not the guy to diminish them, Cole Porter was a well-trained musician, even if he wasn't a master of orchestration. We know Irving Berlin never did learn to read and write music. He could play it at the piano, his secretary would write it down, but he clearly knew how he wanted sound from an orchestra. Richard Rodgers was trained at the Institute of Musical Arts, the predecessor of Juilliard, but he just simply chose not to bother with the orchestrating thing and said, there were specialists who will finish the job for me. So no two songwriters alike. Robert Merrill picking out his tunes on a little xylophone. So I will not deprecate those talents, because what is the audience hum going out the door? It's the tunes written by the songwriter and then the lyrics written by the lyricist. But to turn that into a whole evening of music in the theater, if only for the time, you need the help. And that's the orchestrator's job. For all those lovely Broadway medleys, typically, the songwriter would give you a list of these are the tunes we want to use, these are the ones we don't, and then the arranger, the orchestrator, is turned loose. The songwriter doesn't provide new music for those sorts of things. So everyone Russell worked with, it was a different sort of relationship. He once described his job as providing whatever the composer left out. That's a pretty darn good way to put it. And again, he's just a useful musician who can give you what you need. There's another wonderful quote from him. He says, how you get along with these men when they sometimes need more help than they like to ask for, will have a lot to do with your success.
Mm.
And he was darn good at the diplomacy of his job. And we've all been professionals where we have to work with someone and quietly help them while not acknowledging that we're helping them get something across the finish line. And so all these people that have just raved about his tact, his generosity, that certainly worked well. And also it's famously that at Broadway rehearsals where we're tearing things up, people are arguing, writing new numbers overnight, he was the calmest guy there, reassuring everyone, we'll get this done. Don't worry about it. So he was a steady person to have on the team every time, working in the end on all or part of some 300 Broadway shows. It's a big legacy.
What you were just saying now that kind of points to the stress and strain and sometimes probably sheer terror of putting together a new show, and particularly if it is a struggle to kind of get all the pieces to align, or if certain issues arise or hopes are dashed, or, you know, who knows what. There are all kinds of things that can go wrong. At one point, Robert Russell Bennett says, the opening performance seemed in general, and whatever he's talking about here, to be successful, even though no single department of any musical ever got through an opening on the road without contemplating suicide. It's an interesting way of putting it, but yes, that this is an arena that is fraught with all kinds of tensions and fears. I mean, no matter how frothy and fun the final product might be on the stage, it is blood, sweat, and tears to get it onto the stage. And what you're pointing to is Robert Russell Bennett as a steadying influence in many of these situations. And that's probably something that has gone largely unacknowledged. I mean, even if his name is there on the program or on the album saying, you know, orchestrations by Robert Russell Bennett, he's responsible for even more than that.
He clearly was an asset anywhere he worked. And it's worth reminding you and all our listeners, as I got to talk to many people who had worked with Russell. They've all passed on now. I'm glad I started when I did. But, you know, or for example, we knew a few people from the classical side of the opera stage who wanted to cross over and get onto the Broadway stage. Well, like Pinza did, like who else? I'm thinking some 50s names. And he said, remember, Broadway is a business. Broadway is a cutthroat business. And so if you have all these ideals, like I suppose a lot of teenagers do, about what Broadway is, it is a business. And, of course, every force involved wants things to succeed and get the biggest share of the financial pie that they can. But time is money, and all these things matter. And also, if I'm an opera composer, I can write my dream opera and hope to get someone to stage it. But in Broadway, what do we do when we take a Broadway show out of town? It's a test market. We're letting the audience tell us what they like, and then we change it for them. And so a million composers' and authors' dreams have gone over because the audience didn't like something, and hence these constant needs for rewrites, changes, add a new thing, and all that. So one never knows the dollars are going to come rushing in until the dollars start rushing in.
It's a tough gauntlet. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with George Ferenz about a book he edited called The Broadway Sound, the autobiography and selected essays of Robert Russell Bennett. Robert Russell Bennett had an extraordinarily long and important career on Broadway, orchestrating shows, a career that began in the late teens and stretched into the 1970s. Among the most notable of the shows that he orchestrated was the groundbreaking Showboat by Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein II. I glean from what he writes that Jerome Kern was very skilled, and a lot of what Robert Russell Bennett was just filling in a few blanks. We get a sense that the relationship with Richard Rodgers was a little bit different, and that in a sense Robert Russell Bennett was bringing more to the table, or maybe allowed by Mr. Rodgers to bring more to the musical proceedings. Is that a fair summation of their relationship and the significance Mr. Bennett had with these scores?
I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth. I will say that Jerome Kern and Richard Rodgers both were well-trained musicians who didn't have a big desire to get into the orchestration side of things. They surely had suggestions. But if I look at all of Richard Rodgers' original song scores, you know, the piano vocal of a tune, you do not see instrumental suggestions. This is nice for violins. Here's a cello line. He just writes them at the piano and then turns them on over. Socially, Russell Bennett and Jerome Kern did a lot more off the stage, if you will. You know, Russell talks about yachting with Jerome Kern and all that sort of thing. And with Richard Rodgers, I'm not saying he kept his distance. They just weren't social buddies in that same sort of way. But I won't say that one of them gave the orchestrator more than the other did.
It sounds like it was a rich collaboration on a lot of different levels with both of these men. In the third chapter of the autobiography, Mr. Bennett quotes a very often asked question: where does Dick Rodgers end and you begin? And he calls that a very, very hard question to answer. You were telling me that not only did Mr. Bennett score these shows, that is, you know, when you went to see full performances start to finish, the orchestration you were hearing was Robert Russell Bennett, but then in addition, he would be charged with putting together suites or medleys from these shows that would be played by symphonies all across the country. And you're telling us, you were telling me before we went on the air, that there's actually kind of two tiers in terms of what these medleys and suites are like, and that some are kind of small and approachable, and others are pretty formidable challenges for orchestras to play.
Sure. Let's take a big whole swath of, okay, I'm talking now high school bands and orchestras, community bands and orchestras, and then full-time professional groups like the Milwaukee Symphony, perhaps. If you do a Broadway production, you certainly want to get the music played and get cash out of it any way you can, and getting all these groups to play those medleys of songs from these musicals, Oklahoma, My Fair Lady, whatever, certainly publishers at some point decided to do. If you decide to do it too soon and the show is a flop, you've wasted a lot of money. If you wait too long, you've missed some opportunities too. But for a whole lot of Broadway shows, especially the Rodgers and Hammersteins and Lerner and Lowe's, Russell got charged by the publisher to then turn out these very all-purpose medleys. And as I said, it's a challenge to write something that's playable by a good high school band or orchestra and sounds great. But then when the Milwaukee Symphony plays it, it doesn't sound like educational music. It just sounds even better. And there are a whole lot of those published medleys. And again, they tend to run about 9, 10, maybe 12 minutes, still getting played all the time. If I could mention, by the way, I'm going to drop a name, the Kenosha Pops Concert Band, Craig Gall's groups, they do these things all the time. And I'm very happy that they're getting them out there. And then there's a whole other tier of that sort of thing. Bennett occasionally got asked to do something, let's just say, for the resources of an absolutely professional orchestra and a longer thing. When music came to us on LP records, those were about 24, 25 minutes aside, depending. And so William Steinberg in the Pittsburgh Symphony, this is the early 1960s, said, can you do a big, long 24-minute My Fair Lady, not just an 8 or 10 minutes? And there are a couple of those out there. Luckily, they've all been recorded. They get played live in concert once in a while, but that's where you, and of course, from the orchestrator's point of view, I don't have this little Broadway orchestra of 24 or 25 people. I now have 50 or 75 or 100. I have all the string players I could possibly want, and they can play anything I ask of them. And, of course, that's a wonderful new fresh opportunity to revisit these things. And they're not song accompaniments. It all has to be in the orchestra. But for the for your listeners interested in those big, long 20-ish minute medleys, that's Russell Bennett really getting to tear loose with a Broadway show.
Let's listen to the opening of one such suite. And this is actually what Robert Russell Bennett did with Lerner and Lowe's masterpiece, My Fair Lady. Do you want to say a quick word about what this collaboration was like before we hear a little bit from this extensive suite from their most famous show?
Well, first of all, I have never seen any of the Lerner and Lowe manuscripts, so I don't know exactly what he got for them and how that might compare. I've seen some current things, some Rogers things, but let's just say when they... Oh, here, I could just even do My Fair Lady and Camelot. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Russell Bennett was not available for Brigadoon in the late 1940s, and another arranger named Ted...
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
All that, right? You see the music director and that's it. Okay, it's a very smaller cast list. So for My Fair Lady, 1956, Russell Bennett did more than half the arranging, but it's conventional for only the lead arranger to get their name on the show, not the other ones that contributed. It's just a fact of life. And he was nice enough to write a letter to the production company and say, look, Phil Lang did all this for this. Can we get his name on the show, too? And that's why you see both their names in the credits. It didn't have to be that way, but that was a very nice thing Russell did. I'm going to back up to 1951 and The King and I. And a fair amount, less than half, but a fair amount of that orchestrating was then by another great Broadway orchestrator named Don Walker. I could name a zillion his shows if he wanted. But the basic rule was that the lead orchestrator gets his name on the show, and that's it. And that's why everyone thinks Russell did every note of The King and I, and it's really not true. But, and I'm moving ahead. I'll get back to Lerner and Lowe, I promise
mm-hmm.
you. For My Fair Lady, Russell did more than half. We got both names on the show. For Camelot is 4 years later. What is that, 1960, 61?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Phil Lang, actually, I think, if you count by measures, actually did slightly more than half. Russell Bennett was the better-known name. He's considered the lead orchestrator, but we got both those names on the show. So everything has an initial knowledge in this world. And there are geeks like me that enjoy knowing exactly who arranged which number for which Broadway show, even if their name's not on the credits. That's quite a something. But to bring those two back for Camelot, because they really delivered the sound they wanted for My Fair Lady, that's a testament that they can give you what you want, and, of course, that they were dependable and can turn it in on time and get past all the pitfalls of bringing in a new show in.
Mm. Let's listen to just a little bit of this extensive suite from My Fair Lady, arranged by Robert Russell Bennett. This is going to be the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra and Eric Kunzel from a Telarc CD, which is called the Lerner and Lowe Songbook for Orchestra. Again, here is just a little bit of My Fair Lady. That is some really sophisticated work there. And, of course, it really underscores the fact that this is far more than just a medley of here's the greatest songs from My Fair Lady, but the weaving of various songs together in such expert fashion. I mean, that really shows us Mr. Bennett's genius, doesn't it?
That's where you bring out what I call everything in your composer's toolkit, the ability to get from one song to the next in the medley. And he was much admired for that. You can listen to some other pop medleys. Oh, I'll say some things that are being turned out for high school bands or whatever, and you realize, oh, they get from one song to the other, but it wasn't done quite so artfully. So I imagine, so I admire not just the tune, but how one gets them together, how one smoothly steers you around the corners, if you will.
I do want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about the collaboration that Mr. Bennett had in the 1930s with the great George Gershwin before we hear a little bit from Mr. Bennett's Porgy and Bess, A Symphonic Picture, one of his most famous scores. That is Bennett's score that draws from Gershwin's opera. Explain to our listeners the connection between these two geniuses.
Okay. Almost the same in age. Russell Bennett, born 1894. George Gershwin, born 1898. George Gershwin, the native New Yorker. Russell Bennett, the young man that came from Kansas City to New York to get going in the music business. So here we are in the 19-teens. George Gershwin is trying to get his career going as a songwriter. He gets Swanee in a Broadway show, all those things before he gets to do his first Broadway shows. Russell Bennett started in the music business in New York as a copyist, copying out parts for other arrangers. A million people have started at the bottom like that. And then we should talk about commercial arrangements. I could call them theater orchestra arrangements, dance band arrangements. For orchestras of varying size, the term we use is stock arrangements. And Russell Bennett eventually got to doing those. Imagine, if you will, having to turn out a published arrangement of a new Broadway song, maybe Swanee, where it has to sound good if all you have is a piano and a violin and a cello. If you have six more instruments, it sounds even better. If you have 25, it sounds even better. A true all-purpose arrangement with keys for missing instruments and such. And so by the 19-teens, Russell Bennett in New York Publishing had moved up to be one of the great stock arrangers because he could do this very well and quickly. There's always that quickly sort of thing. So Russell Bennett was arranging Gershwin songs, these stock orchestrations, played all over the country, maybe even all over the world, before he actually got to arrange a Gershwin song for a Broadway show. And as he tells us, it sounds kind of backwards, that it's a higher prestige thing to arrange a song for a Broadway show where it's going to be heard in one theater 8 times a week rather than the stock arrangements played everywhere. But on Broadway, you're making that arrangement for the first hearing of a show. You're going to decide how a song is going to sound when it makes its debut, like being a rock album record producer. How is this sound, how's the song going to sound? And so gradually then by the early 20s, Russell Bennett is doing Broadway arrangements, and he's arranging for the Gershwin shows. Those two got along very well. There's only a little bit of written correspondence, but Bennett writes really about it and realizes what a terrific talent George Gershwin was. And the people that get deep into George Gershwin's ability as an arranger or orchestrator, in 1924 for Rhapsody in Blue, he wasn't quite prepared to do that for Paul Whiteman, but with his later works, he does that. And I could go in and criticize one little thing that Gershwin does here or there, but Russell said, no, George Gershwin learned a great deal about orchestration, but for the Broadway shows, George Gershwin is the songwriter, a new show is in rehearsal, George Gershwin didn't have time to do the orchestrations, even if he cared to. So for the Broadway shows, typically Gershwin would maybe orchestrate one number or so. But Russell's right there, and they hung together. And, of course, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but in the late 30s, George Gershwin's last years in Hollywood, doing the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers musicals and things, Russell Bennett is right there, kind of providing whatever the songwriter doesn't. I find it wonderful that George Gershwin had his concert hall aspirations in addition to Broadway. That's another thing those two shared. We can work both sides of the fence. And there's his opera Porgy and Bess, which debuts in 1935. Gershwin, again, and he died in 1937. So in those last years, Gershwin had made up an orchestra suite, a concert suite of clips from the opera, including some things that got cut. When the show got first staged, they had to get rid of a few things. But just a few years later, here we're in the Midwest, we should know about conductor Fritz Reiner, who, among other things, had a wonderful tenure with Chicago Symphony in the 50s and 60s, the very talented Fritz Reiner. He and George Gershwin were very close. When Fritz Reiner had the Cincinnati Symphony in the 20s, he was bringing George Gershwin in to be his soloist. So a very early classical champion of George Gershwin's work. Fritz Reiner is the conductor George Gershwin wanted for Porgy and Bess, but he simply couldn't get him. Fritz Reiner had other commitments. So to move ahead a little bit, Gershwin died in 1937. And just a few years later, Fritz Reiner said, you know, we really need a big orchestral medley from Porgy and Bess, a whole big 20-ish minute sort of thing. And that's the symphonic picture of Porgy and Bess, which is still out there, still getting played all the time. It's been recorded commercially more than 30 times. And in the classical Gershwin world, there's a little bit of rivalry. Some people say, oh, no, Gershwin's thing was better. And some say, no, the symphonic picture was better. But it has a great life. Fritz Reiner actually laid out that medley, the symphonic picture. There's a wonderful document in Fritz Reiner's hand of, we'll start with this number. We'll use this many bars of this number. Next, we'll use this. We're going to have to transpose it. But you can say Fritz Reiner kind of designs the symphonic picture almost down to the measure. And then Russell Bennett, he has Gershwin's full score for Porgy and Bess, but he has an even bigger orchestra, no singers, and then he turns out this wonderful, evocative symphonic picture of Porgy and Bess. It's 24 minutes long because it was designed, this is before the LP record, it was designed for the larger 78-inch records, which could hold 4 minutes of music on the side. So three of those records, 4 minutes, six sides, that's 24 minutes. So it was a piece designed for a very specific length, and Reiner made one of the very first recordings. So I would tell any of your audience members, if you look at the symphonic picture, make sure it lasts 24-ish minutes, because a couple conductors chop off the first several minutes and give you only 18 of it, and they're not doing the darn thing justice. Even Andre Craven cuts the front of it. But I think it's a wonderful orchestral medley, which tells us great things both about George Gershwin and about Russell Bennett.
Here is just a little bit of the symphonic picture, John, from Gershwin's opera, Porgy and Bess. This happens to be Detroit Symphony Orchestra, led by Antal Durati. This is a recording of the entire symphonic picture of Robert Russell Bennett. One forgets that the score to Porgy and Bess is a lot more than just the big tunes, and Robert Russell Bennett's orchestration here of the symphonic picture is truly extraordinary. Well, that is actually all the time we have, and we have just scratched the surface of an extraordinary career. And you can read much more about Robert Russell Bennett in this book, The Broadway Sound, The Autobiography and Selected Essays of Robert Russell Bennett, edited by my guest, George Ferenz. George Ferenz, thank you so much for sharing your expertise today in talking about this great, great musician. And I look forward to our next conversation very much.
I've been happy to be here today, and I look forward to another opportunity to speak with you and your listeners. Thanks so much.